A Life of Jesus by Brother Melva Purkis. Book 7, Chapter 5, by King Cometh. On the first day of the week, the king came to Jerusalem. He entered the city, acclaimed by multitudes, growing delirious with joy and hope. The glad cries of the crowd had been in his ears from the moment he left Bethany and took that road that winds over the Mount of Olives from the east. Arriving at Bethpage, he had sent his disciples to fetch him an ass, and mounting it in lowly dignity, the journey had proceeded. About a mile from Jerusalem, he was met by a surging wave of people, for the most part pilgrims lodging in the city or camping outside its walls. The news of his coming had gone before him, and they had come forth to meet him. The air, "Hosanna," they cried, "blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Blessed be the kingdom of our father David, it cometh in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest." Branches ripped from palm trees, robes quickly pulled from shoulders, made a pathway for the ass's feet. His enemies watched in anger and apprehension. They had fallen out amongst themselves. "Perceive ye," said some, "how ye prevail nothing. Behold, the world is gone after him." Some had even approached him and implored him to stop this madness. But Jesus had acquiesced in the clamour of the people. If these should hold their peace, the very stones would cry out. Unknown to them, their hour was near. Soon the cries of the people would support them against him, but for the moment, provincial Jews were enjoying their short-lived jubilation. By the evening, they would be silent and thoughtful. Yes, there was evidence of inconsistency in this scene of the victorious king riding into the city, not upon a war horse followed by 1,000 spears, but upon an ass's colt surrounded by undisciplined crowds. Looking more carefully into the reader's face, we discern a man of sorrows rather than a kingly conqueror. A few moments ago, breasting the shoulder of Olivet, the city of Jerusalem had suddenly come into full view. Jesus had brought his ass to a sound standstill, and the crowds had become strangely quiet. He had looked long and earnestly at this city, its buildings crowding to its walls, its palaces lofty and imperious looking out over the limestone hills, its temple alone in solitary splendour high above the valley. And as he looked, his face had grown troubled. The present faded. 40 years sped swiftly by. He saw the city encompassed by a relentless enemy. Flames licked hungrily about its dwellings, smoke billowed from its heart, and rolled heavily away into the distance. Its beautiful buildings were visibly crumbling as masonry fell under the inexorable attack. His sensitive ear caught the cries of agony and terror. His penetrating eye saw the blood-stained dead and the emaciated bodies of the dying. Jesus lifted up his voice and called across the valley to this stricken city, gleaming now in the morning sunlight, oblivious of these distant clouds. "If thou hadst known, even thou, at least in this thy day, the things that belong unto thy peace, but now they are hid from thine eyes." Jesus saw all too clearly the result of their neglect, and because he saw, he wept. "The days shall come upon thee that thine enemies shall cast a trench about thee, encompass thee round, and keep thee in on every side, and shall lay thee even with the ground, and thy children within thee. And they shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knowest not the time of thy visitation." But now the procession had moved on again. The roaring crowds were sweeping down the slopes of Olivet, crossing the waters of the brook Kedron, and entering through the gate into the city. In the narrow streets, the confusion became chaotic and the shouting inarticulate. The inhabitants rushed to their doors, climbed on their roofs, and asked again and again, "Who is this?" The multitude flung back the answer proudly, "This is Jesus, the prophet of Nazareth of Galilee." Matthew tells us that all the city was moved. Yet there was an anticlimax to this momentous day. Gradually, it became evident that Jesus was not prepared to take advantage of this tumultuous popularity. He was not going to supplement it by his miraculous power and assert his messiahship. As the day wore on, the disappointed crowds grew listless and drifted away. Jesus went into the temple and looked carefully round, observing the evidences that the house of God was still a place of barter and merchandise. As the evening shadows lengthened, he turned sorrowfully away from the city, retracing his steps over the Mount of Olives, and returned with the 12 to the welcome warmth of the home in Bethany. How Jesus spent the night at Bethany we have no means of telling, but we do know that the previous day had been one of intense emotion. We know too that similar experiences had been followed by a night of prayer. He was on his way back to Jerusalem with his disciples before the morning sun had risen over the hills of Moab, and he hungered. This seems to suggest that this night too had been spent on some lonely hill under the starry sky. Moreover, the incident that occurred on this short journey to the city showed that his mind was still full of that vision of Jerusalem that had wrung from his lips the cry of mingled pleading and judgment the day before. Dare we lift the veil enough to perceive a night of intercession for his people, as Moses had interceded in the past? Can we see the sequel to the unfinished parable of the barren fig tree, the husbandman pleading with the owner of the vineyard for the preservation of the unfruitful tree for another year, a further opportunity of digging, dunging, and careful tending? Is it possible to interpret in his subsequent actions the irrevocable answer of his father that there can be no reprieve from the sentence Israel has brought upon herself? She will refuse her Messiah, and she will pay the inexorable penalty. The scene which Jesus had envisaged from the hill above the city will move from prophecy into reality and pass on into history, taking its place in the great purpose of God. In some sheltered spot by the roadside, a fig tree attracted the attention of Jesus, as it must have drawn the wondering eyes of many travellers on their way to the Passover. At that time, the time of year, the fig trees were normally without either fruit or leaves. The sight suited his purpose well, for it presented him with the opportunity of giving a practical illustration of the parable of the barren fig tree, and of completing a picture which had been left in abeyance. The time of figs was not yet. They appeared before the leaves. Here was a fig tree which made great boast of itself, challenging those who passed by to behold from the richness of its foliage the succulence of its fruits. Yet accepting the invitation, the hungry wayfarer was doomed to disappointment, for in spite of its lofty pretensions, this tree was no better than the other trees. Its fault lay not so much in its barrenness as in its empty promise. No more penetrating picture of Israel can be imagined than that afforded by this sheltered tree, with its abundance of green leaves stirring gently in the morning air. Nor can we confine the picture to natural Israel. It must ever be a challenge to Israel after the Spirit also. The richness of the promise must be supported by the abundance of the fruit. The disciples were startled to hear their master addressing the fig tree as though it was an animate being. "Let no fruit grow on thee henceforth for ever." Night had probably fallen before they passed the spot on their return to Bethany, and it was not until the following morning that they saw the effect of these words of Jesus. They looked with amazement upon the withered tree, its stark branches raised in unavailing gesticulation to the heavens. "Master," cried Peter, "behold, the fig tree which thou cursest is withered away." Yet for the time the lesson was lost upon them. They would see this incident in its true light later on, and then they would understand. There were those who would live to witness the final rebellion of an overburdened nation and see the withering effect of the military might of Rome. But for the moment they saw only the power of Christ upon the fig tree, and were impressed by the deed and not the motive. Jesus, knowing that the time of understanding would come, forbore to correct the mistaken emphasis. He told them again, as he had told them before, that such works of power were the result of perfect faith, and with the smallest faith they could overcome the greatest obstacles. With his thoughts upon the people rather than upon himself, Jesus continued his early morning journey to the city. Yesterday it had been late afternoon when he went into the temple. The business for the day was over. But this time he found the commercial traffic in full spate, preparing for the lucrative business of the approaching feast. As he had done nearly 3 years before, he swept through the court of the Gentiles, turning out all those who bought and sold. He sent the coins scattering across the stone pavement as he turned over the money changers' tables, and his voice rang out clearly above the muffled curses and scurrying footsteps. "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer'? But ye have made it a den of thieves." When the ungodly and ambitious had been ejected from the temple courts, they were replaced by those who were in true need of the sanctuary of God. The blind and the lame came to him, and he healed them. He had other visitors too. Those who falsely called themselves the children of God were removed, and the children he loved came to fill their place. Echoing the shouts they'd heard all about them yesterday, they cried, "Hosanna to the Son of David." And when those temple officials saw these things, they were sore displeased. "Hearest thou what these say?" "Yea," he replied, "have you never read, 'Out of the mouth of babes and sucklings thou hast perfected praise'?" For the second time that morning, the Lord had stood before her victory, luxuriant in its outward adornments. The morning sun shone upon its stately columns. Its priests were resplendent in their ornate robes. It was a picture breathtaking in its beauty and promise, but it was barren. In purging the temple the second time, his words were of judgment rather than entreaty, and soon the external splendour would fade before the savage onslaught of Rome. Once more, Jesus left the city and returned to the seclusion of Bethany.